Hello and welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 216, and we're going to have an emergency episode to talk about the heat that is encroaching upon most of the eastern half of the U.S., and we're also going to talk about pests, because that was what I was originally going to talk about. We're going to talk about absorption versus compressor fridges, a tale from the road involving a particularly troublesome stone, and a product review of one of the most simple things you can have in your van, a coffee mug. Sometimes it's the little things that make a big difference. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me here once again for episode 216. I was going to talk all about pests this week and the various kinds of pests that can get into your van and cause trouble. And in fact, I still am. But I feel like I need to address the fact that many of you out there on the road right now are suffering in this unprecedented heat wave. Folks, it's not even summer yet. Yet if you're in the eastern half of the United States right now, you are sweltering. Records are being broken left and right, and I just spent a couple days living in the Airstream in this weather, and the Airstream, with all its fancy stuff, struggled a bit. I have to say that once it got to 95, the air conditioning wasn't cooling it so much, and the refrigerator was struggling. I'll talk more about that later. And so those of you in vans, I feel you. I know what you're going through. So I thought I would talk about some things that you can do to mitigate this heat. And, you know, it's a tough problem. You basically have to not be where the heat is. And some of us don't have that option. But let's just go through the list here. And hopefully something here might help you out even just a little bit. Now, the first thing is, number one, stay mobile. If at all possible, move. Go somewhere where the weather is going to be better. Go higher elevation, or go somewhere maybe more north, depending. I mean, this heat dome seems to be mostly in the north, so you have to focus that. But what I do when I'm traveling far away from home and I encounter heat is I will pay very close attention to the forecasts, and I will try to spend my night someplace where it's going to cool down below 80. And I will plan my day based on that. And sometimes that means going up in elevation. Sometimes that means driving a couple hours north or whatever. But I try to stay mobile as possible. Even if I have a beautiful campsite, there is no such thing as a beautiful campsite if it's 95 and humid. It's not worth it. Get a good place to sleep if you can. Number two, and this is very serious. This might be the biggest piece of advice in here. Don't care what the temperature is during the day. No, seriously, the daytime temperature isn't the important part, because you can get out of your van during the day. You can go into a city and go to a library or go to a mall or something like that and just get your stuff done and stay out of the heat. It's nighttime that's the problem. Being able to sleep, this is the difficulty. So whenever I'm involved in a heat wave situation and I'm in my van or a trailer, I always focus on the nighttime temperatures. For me, 80 degrees Fahrenheit seems to be about the sweet spot. And I guess that translates to about 27 Celsius. That is the level at which I can turn on all my fans and have all my vents open and be able to sleep without too much trouble. Anything more than that, it gets to be a problem. So that's what I aim for. But the nighttime temps are really what's important, because you can always find something to do during the day to stay cool. Number three, this one's pretty obvious, have lots of fans. Lots of fans. Not one fan, not just your max fan in the roof. Everyone has different tolerances for the feeling of wind blowing on them. I know some people absolutely hate that feeling. I love it. In fact, if I don't have that feeling, I feel kind of weird. I mean, I love my venti fan. I'll have a link in the show notes for the venti fan. But I love my venti, and I love that it's portable and I can carry it with me everywhere. People have seen me walking down the street with my venti. I love the feeling of wind blowing over me. So on really hot days and nights, I will have as many as 4 or 5 fans blowing on all different parts of my body. And that's what keeps me sane. So if that's something you can tolerate, it really does help. By the way, just sidetrack here. You know, we know that fans cool you off. People don't actually spend a lot of time talking about how fans work and what they're doing. Fans are doing nothing more than blowing air over the surface of your body, which evaporates moisture, and that evaporation process cools you down. That's it. Fans don't cool the air. In fact, they slightly warm the air. Also, just as a side note, you may have heard of something called fan death. This is the theory that if you are in an enclosed room with a fan running, the fan will chop up the air and break the oxygen molecules or something and make it so that you can't breathe the air and you will die. This is actually a common belief in Korea, or at least it was at one time. It's crap. It's not true at all. The fan isn't going to do anything more than move the air around. Number four, kind of obvious, but needs to be mentioned, drink more than you want to. In the heat, you are going through a lot of water, even if it doesn't matter if you're sweating or not, because it's your body temperature that dictates how much water you need. And you're always sweating, but if you're in a dry climate, you're sweating and you can't notice it. I was just in Colorado. I was probably sweating up a storm, but I wasn't getting wet because it was 10% humidity, which, in my opinion, cannot support human life. But you have to drink a lot. Drink a lot of water. Do whatever you can, you know, set a timer, whatever, drink a lot of water. I think in general, people are a little obsessed with how much water they drink, but this is a time where that might be an actual good thing. So drink more than you want. Don't wait until you get thirsty. Number five, and this is advice from experience and the experience of others. If you find yourself in a heat wave and you don't have an air conditioning solution in your van, now is not the time to try to figure one out. Working on your van in this heat is miserable, and I've seen people do crazy things like try to run tubes from their air conditioning in their dashboard into the back of their van, or they'll go and buy an industrial air conditioner and try to fit it in their van, or they'll try to make one out of ice in a cooler. Give up on all of that. That's stuff to experiment when the temperatures are good enough for working on your van. If you try to do that while you're hot, while you're actually in a heat wave, you're just going to end up frustrated and hot. You're probably not going to solve the problem. So save that for another time. Do something else to stay cool. Number six, you know, this is a crappy solution, but it is a solution. Rest areas have air conditioning, most of them anyway. Welcome centers, rest areas that are open at night that have restrooms, usually that area is air conditioned. It usually has Wi-Fi. There's water. It's kind of an emergency oasis if you need it. So if you're near an interstate, you probably are near a rest area, and as a last resort, you could go there. And it's not the coolest place to be. It's not the most fun place to be, but it can help you get through the night, and that's really what we're trying to do here. Now, during the day, heck, you can do whatever you're going to do. Now, if you're camping way out in the middle of BLM land, which doesn't seem to be as affected by this heat dome that we're in right now, yeah, you're going to sit outside the van and do whatever you're going to do, and it's going to be hot. That's a little tricky. But if you're near a city, you can go to the library and get your work done. You can go to the movies. You can go to the mall. You can go to a museum. There's many, many things you can do where there's some air conditioning. And hey, here's a crazy idea. If you find a super hot day and you don't know what to do with yourself, call the local food bank and ask if they need help that day. You can go and be in their air-conditioned warehouse and be doing something good for people. That's going to make you feel good no matter what. And number eight, as a last resort, you can idle your vehicle and run the air conditioning. Now, I don't recommend this. Modern vehicles, the way the air conditioning works, is it's meant to be cooling the vehicle while the engine is moving through the air. The cooling system of the vehicle is designed to take advantage of the air going over the radiator and the condenser coils at speed. Yes, there are fans that if the speed isn't sufficient, the fans will kick on, but it's hard on your engine. Now, doing this is better than dying. I'm about to head out on a trip this week right through this heat dome in my ambulance, but my ambulance has air conditioning in the back that runs off the engine. I still don't like idling. I know that diesels idle better than gasoline engines, and I will idle my rig if I have to run that rear AC. But it's the last resort. That's only if I can't come up with any other options. And finally, I don't have this listed here, but it just comes to me. If you have some emergency money, this wouldn't be a bad time to go to a hotel, you know, just for your own peace of mind. It doesn't have to be a fancy hotel. It just has to have air conditioning and a shower. Your peace of mind is going to improve so much. And maybe if you're lucky, you can get together with a couple of people and, you know, share like a Motel 6 or something with a couple of other van life folks, and, you know, it won't cost you an arm and a leg. So anyway, I feel for you. I hope the heat breaks soon. Again, it's not even summer yet. And, you know, if the global warming predictions are accurate, this is our new normal. And boy, I'm glad lithium prices are coming down, because we might get to a point where AC is required in every van build. Now, what I wanted to talk about, pests. This is going to be a little weird episode. We're doing another main segment here. And in fact, before I start this main segment, let me get some business out of the way. Thanks to everybody who has donated to the show at buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. A special thank you to those of you who are recurring donors. I absolutely appreciate what you do. And because of what you do, there are no ads in this podcast. So if you're listening to this podcast and you like the fact that there are no ads, you can thank those folks that have donated some money. And you can become one if you're so inclined. And you can visit buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. That's 2 T's, not 3. Not one. I thank you, and everyone else thanks you, too. Okay, now on to pests. This is what I was going to talk about, because I just came back from a trip in Colorado. I went out with my Scamp, so I had my pickup truck and my Scamp, and I came back, and now I'm, you know, getting the ambulance ready for this trip to New England. I'm about to go to Vermont. My oldest child, Fisher, is about to release a single, and he invited me to the show where he's going to perform it for the first time, so I'm excited about going to that. Yes, I have two kids. They're both musical. Simon Wag does the music for this show, and Fisher Wag does his own music, and if I have something to link, I will, but he hasn't released it yet, so I can't link it. But unfortunately for me, I'm going to be going right through this heat dome, which is what we just talked about. But more unfortunate for me is that when I opened the van, I found that my very expensive wool blanket that I use to cover the futon that is my bed was missing a part of it, because some little mouse rat thing had gotten into my van and chewed up a significant portion of my blanket. I mean, no, you couldn't have chewed up the cotton towels or the paper towels or the washcloth or anything like that. No, you had to go right for probably the most expensive piece of fabric I had in the van. Thank you, little mouse rat thing. So frustrating. And this has been a constant problem for all of our rigs, because if you leave a rig parked somewhere long enough, rodents and other animals are going to get in there. So what do you do? Well, the first thing you can do is don't leave your rig in one place. And this isn't always easy. If you move your rig around regularly, you're going to have much less problem with this type of thing. But if it sits in the same place over and over and over again, and which is the situation I'm in, I have to do this. Eventually, they're going to find their way in. Now, what attracts them to go into your van? What can you do to mitigate the attraction? Well, that's pretty tricky. They are attracted to food, obviously. So any kind of food that's in there, they're going to like. But they're also attracted to bedding materials. And that's difficult, because you're going to have bedding materials in your van. They're there for you. And the mice like them, too. And we've had them in the Winnebago. We've had them in where they've made nests all over the place with all of the materials. It's been a real pain in the butt. And now in the van, I'm actually pretty upset about this, because that was a very nice blanket. And this gets to the next point, is the damage they can do. Okay, so they ruin my blanket. That bites. But now I have to find those pieces of blanket, because I know this mouse made a nest with that blanket. I did find a nest in my van, but it was made out of a chewed up storage container, not those pieces of blanket. So somewhere in my van, there's a nest made out of this blanket. And the problem with those nests is that they can harbor things like fleas and ticks and mites and stuff like that. But the bigger problem is that they smell. Mice just pee in their nests. They don't care. And that odor is persistent and horrible. The mice that ate my kayak, which happened a while ago and I talked about last year, built this massive nest in the bag that the kayak was in. It was an inflatable kayak. And the shed that I had that in still smells like mice. It's been over a year. It's been a winter and a summer, and I've cleaned everything I possibly can. So that's a big problem. And I haven't found the nest yet. And that means to me, because I've looked as many places as I can, they built the nest in the walls of the van, meaning that the nest is between the outside of the van and one of the inner walls, and that's bad. So I've got that to deal with. How do you deal with this, though? Well, if you are constantly going to your van, like once a day, you can use a trap, like a have-a-heart trap. These are traps that are called humane traps. The mouse or whatever gets in the trap, and then it's caught, but it's still alive, and then you can let it go. There's a couple of problems with this, though. One is, if you let it go, it's going to just come back. So where are you going to let it go? Oh, you're going to drive it several miles away and let it go. Okay, yeah, that might work, except maybe that was a mama mouse and you have just made her miles away from her babies. I mean, there's cruelty involved here no matter what. It's a tricky, tricky problem to solve. And then there are things like poison, like decon and stuff like that. And the way that stuff works is the mice eat the poison and then become incredibly thirsty. It actually thins their blood. It's made out of warfarin, if you've ever heard of that. That's a drug humans use too, but it basically thins their blood, and the reaction to that is that they desperately seek water, and they usually can't find that in your vehicle. So they will leave your vehicle or your house or garage or whatever and go out and try to find that water and then die outside. And theoretically, it's a first generation killer, such that if a hawk or something eats that mouse, it won't harm the hawk, but there's a lot of controversy about that. And it also seems a little bit cruel. That doesn't sound like a great way to die, but it's not as cruel as glue traps. Glue traps are exactly what they sound like. They're these little panels of glue, and a mouse walks on them and then gets stuck, and then stays there until it dehydrates and dies, which could take days. Not a great solution. I had an exterminator recommend them to me once when I had a house with a mouse problem, and I just was like, no, I actually fired the exterminator. So what do I do with my mouse problem? Well, this is also controversial, but after thinking of all the options, my best solution is the classic old mouse trap. The snap on the neck mouse trap, instant death, very effective. And to me, it is the lowest level of cruelty when combined with the highest level of effectiveness. The only problems with these things are is that they can go off by themselves. Sometimes you might catch something that you didn't want to. I actually caught a bird in one once. I don't know what the bird was doing in my garage, but, you know, birds aren't the problem. And if you don't check it all the time, you'll end up with this rotting dead mouse in your van, and that's no good either. So I know people don't like killing things. I don't like killing things, but the amount of damage a rodent can do in your vehicle is enormous. The stuff I'm dealing with is literally just annoyance. I can get another blanket. It's not a big deal. But if they get into the wiring of your vehicle and start chewing on the wires, and this is a problem with more modern vehicles as they switched insulations from different kinds of plastic to a soy-based plastic, which actually is like food, well, then you can destroy your vehicle. I had an old minivan that mice got into, and they chewed the injector wires, meaning that I couldn't drive the vehicle. It cost me hundreds of dollars to fix that, all because a mouse got in there. So that's mice. And I know, people are upset that I'm killing mice, but folks, I am going to protect my van. And this is the best I can come up with, given that my van sits by itself for long periods of time. There is no have-a-heart method I can use, and that is the least cruel. If you want to at me, feel free. I'm Jeff at BuiltToGo.com. Two T's, not three, not one. Now, people might say, well, why don't you use all the repellents? And there are hundreds of different repellents on the market you can use for mice. And, well, my truism here is that whenever there are 100 solutions for something, there are no solutions for something. I just don't think they work. All the, oh, they don't like mint, or they don't like Uncle Gus's little packs, or they don't like peppermint oil, or olive oil, or vanilla-scented air fryer. I mean, there's 8 million different things that will definitely keep mice out of your van. Or what about lights? You turn on lights. Well, none of that stuff seems to be very effective to me. Oh, and those ultrasonic things? Yeah, they do nothing. So yeah, I don't think any of that stuff works. I've tried a lot of it. I've never seen any difference, so I just disregard those entirely, which unfortunately leaves me with killing the mice. Now, what about other pests? Let's talk about ants. Little sugar ants, little tiny ants, they are a persistent problem, and the Terra baits, those liquid gel baits that you can get at any place that sells things that kill things, those work really well for that. The idea is that the ants get in there, take the food back to the nest, and kill the queen, and that kills the entire nest. Yeah, okay, I'm killing things again, but, I mean, it's ants. They are winning the biomass war. I'm not terribly worried about ants. And they can also do a lot of damage. They can get into your electrical outlets and even cause fires. So ants do need to be dealt with. Moths are another thing. You know, if a transient moth flies into your van, that's not a big deal. But if you see persistent, like the same kind of moth over and over again, even during the day, you might have a flower moth or a pantry moth problem. That means there's probably some water getting into your rig, and there's either some wet cardboard or old wet food or wet paper of some sort. That's what these things breed in. So if you see a lot of those, worry, because you've got a moisture problem that you need to solve. The best way to deal with those that I've found is these little sticky traps that you just kind of put up there and the moths fly in and get stuck. Oh yeah, look at me, I'm doing the glue traps for moths. Yeah, all right, I feel differently about rodents than I do moths. I'm a hypocrite, I suppose, but, you know, the other option is just to spray the heck out of your van with some kind of pesticide, which is also effective, but, you know, then you're living in pesticide. Other pests I'm not going to get into. You know, porcupines can be a pest in certain areas. Raccoons can be pests, all those kind of things. But those are the big ones to deal with. So, yeah, you got to take pests seriously. And I know it's difficult, but in many cases, the best thing to do is just to kill them. And I take no pleasure in it. And I certainly don't take any pleasure in opening up my van and seeing a dead mouse sitting there with its neck broken. And now I have to remove that from the trap. But I do feed my dead mice to the local wildlife, so it's the circle of life. Tech Talk. Oh, I've run into this problem several times lately, so I'm just going to talk about it. There are two basic kind of refrigerators you can have in an RV or a camper van. The one we talk about most often is the 12-volt compressor fridge. You can also have a 110-volt compressor fridge or whatever your mains power is for those of you in other countries. And those basically work on the same technology. There's a compressor that is compressing a gas. As that gas expands, it absorbs heat, and the heat goes out the back, and then the cycle starts again. The gas is compressed, blah, blah, blah. That's how compressor refrigerators work. That's how the refrigerator in your home probably works. And that is what's most common for people building out their vans. In RVs, what has been most common for probably 70 years are absorption fridges. So absorption refrigerators work differently. They don't have any moving parts except liquid. I mean, they do require some electricity to run electronics in some cases, but there's no fan, there's no compressor. It's all done by the movement of liquid. You have a heat source that can be either electric or gas, and that heat heats up the liquid, which causes this cycle where ammonia and hydrogen and water all mix together, and there's a bunch of phase changes, and every phase change withdraws heat from the fridge, etc. You can look up the details if you want, but it's a very simple system. However, it is not so simple that it doesn't need maintenance. So I have used both of these fridges extensively. Which do I think is better? I will take a 12-volt compressor fridge any day of the week. And there is a big battle going on in the Airstream groups right now because Airstream is shifting away from the absorption refrigerators and heading mostly towards full-size 12-volt compressor refrigerators. And people are all upset because, oh, it was so nice boondocking with the gas refrigerator. I didn't have to worry about any electricity and whatever. And to me, technology has changed. Things have shifted. Batteries are more powerful and far less expensive now. We have solar in abundance that can keep those batteries charged. So to me, the question is, do you want a refrigerator that runs on gas, or do you want a refrigerator that runs on sunlight? Because that's basically how it is. And I will choose sunlight every time. I have a 30-year-old absorption fridge in my Scamp, and it works. It's fine. And one nice thing about these absorption fridges is that with no moving parts, they can last forever. So long as it doesn't spring a leak, there's really not much to go wrong. Except whenever you burn something, you produce things like soot. And my problem is that the flame for heating the liquids will go out after a certain period of time. And what I have to do is take apart the entire heating mechanism and blow it out. And I ran into this while I was camping, and I was annoyed because I had done a test. Before I went out to Colorado, I had tested the fridge for a week, and it worked fine on gas. And then I got out there, and not so much. And maybe it's because of the altitude. altitude or whatever, I don't know. Maybe it's because the scamp got shaken up and stuff got, I don't know. But the solution, and I know what the solution is to take the entire thing out and blow all the pipes out and put it back together. Unfortunately, the way they built the scamp, you can't get at stuff. It's all embedded in there, and it's a nightmare. And the whole time, it made me just wish I had my 12-volt fridge. Oh, but you're saying, but Jeff, it's a three-way fridge. It'll run on 110 volts or 12 volts or gas. Why didn't you just use 12 volts? And the answer is that the 12 volts required for an absorption fridge is heat. And remember, heat is one of the things that uses up batteries faster than anything else. So I actually did, after I got frustrated with dealing with the gas, I set it to 12 volts and let it run my 200 amp hour battery down. And it did in 2 days. Even with full sun, it ran down my battery in 2 days. And that's why. If it was a 12 volt compressor fridge of the same size, I could have lasted a month without worrying about it. So if you have the choice, I would always, always, always go with a 12-volt compressor fridge. The only time that an absorption fridge is better is if it's already installed in your rig and it's what you got, or you're in a situation that for some reason you have ready access to propane and that's your best solution. So that's the big difference. Whenever you hear two-way or three-way fridge, that's an absorption fridge. And whenever you hear residential fridge or compressor fridge, that's normally what we're using. Product review. Sometimes it's the simple things. When you go on safari in Africa, one of the things they tend to do is have a little coffee break in the wilderness, or depending on what time of night, you know, you might have a sunset safari drive and they'll have beer and stuff. But we had a few morning ones and they would break out coffee and hot chocolate and stuff. Now, all the stuff for the coffee and hot chocolate has to come with you in the Jeep or the Land Cruiser or whatever you're in, so it has to be pretty rugged. So there's no glass, generally. I mean, you might have beer bottles, but you don't use, like, fine china. No, what they had were these stainless steel cups, and I loved them. And, well, to be honest, they matched the aesthetics of the Airstream, so we bought a couple of them. But now that I've been using them for a couple months, I think they're a really good solution to having a coffee mug in your van that you're not worried about it breaking. Now, the truth is that in our lives, we get free coffee mugs all the time. I mean, that's just a thing. People give you a coffee mug for, hey, you donated to PBS, congratulations, or you came to this event, here's your coffee mug. You probably have more coffee mugs than you want. But if you're looking for a performance coffee mug, the ones I have linked here are actually pretty good. They're full-size coffee mugs. They hold 15 ounces. They're stainless steel, and they're double-walled. That means they actually insulate, and they insulate really well. So you put a cold liquid in there or a hot liquid in there, it will stay cold or hot for quite a while. Now, that's usually not the case with metal mugs, because metal's a great conductor, but because these have a vacuum wall in them, they actually keep things cold or warm a good amount of time. Obviously, being stainless steel, they're completely shatterproof. It's not like you're going to break them in any way. And they have a very generous and very comfortable handle. They're just very simple things. And for $25, you can get two of them. They are made by, I have no idea. I don't know. The brand is called Real Deal Steel, I guess. Okay, Real Deal Steel. That's who they're made by. I didn't know that. But you know what? It's just a nice, simple thing. And if you were artistic, you could carve your name into one of them or etch whatever you wanted into the side. This is the kind of mug that you could clip to your belt, clip to the back of your backpack, toss in a box in your van, and you will never have to worry about it. Also, it's real easy to clean. Being stainless steel, nothing sticks to it. It's really easy to wash. One caveat. I know there are camping mugs that you can also cook in. These are not them. Do not cook in these. Obviously, don't put them in the microwave, but also do not put them on a cooktop. Because they have that double wall, there's space in there, and you don't want to heat that space up. Even though it's supposed to be a vacuum, there's probably some atmosphere in there, and heating that up would be bad. So don't heat things in these. That's it, folks. Really simple thing, just one of these daily pleasures. Every morning I make coffee, I'm very happy to grab this mug, and heck, you might be too. So there's a link in the show notes, but if you'd like to search for it on Amazon, it is stainless steel double-walled mugs, 100% BPA-free, 15-ounce metal coffee and teacup mug, insulated cups with handles, keep drinks hot or cold longer, durable for camping, set of two shatterproof mugs. Take that, SEO. Tales from the Road. I am a white male living in the United States and of a certain age that I am at a high risk for kidney stones. And everybody dreads the kidney stones. And my father had kidney stones, oh, right about the same age as I am now. And yeah, yes, I have had the stones. And yeah, they're pretty bad. They have been described as painful as giving birth. And I don't know that that's true or not, and I don't care to make that comparison. All I can tell you is that they hurt. I want to tell you my experience with them for a couple of reasons, but one is to show what healthcare is like in the United States. So I live in Chicago. I had this problem when I was in Chicago. I had a dull ache in the back of my back, in my lower back, for a few hours, and it was just getting worse and worse. And I thought to myself, this might be a kidney stone. It could be. What do I do? So I talked to my wife, the doctor, and she says, let's go to the ER. And so we go to the ER. Now, the ER we went to is Northwestern. It's the largest hospital in the area. It's a highly regarded hospital. And this is during COVID, so things are complicated. Everyone's got masks on, and they've got a secondary waiting room open that used to be the foyer of another medical building, and there are a lot of people there. It is a mess. And so we check in at the desk and, you know, go have a seat. And then almost an hour later, they call me in for triage. Now, right away, you should be having some red flags go up, because triage is where they decide if you're in danger of imminent death or not. So it took an hour for them to get to that stage. They looked at me, they checked me over, they took my blood pressure, and that was it. They did nothing. They said, go have a seat. I got no medication or anything, and I, you know, I'm in excruciating pain. The ride to the hospital, every bump, every turn of the car was just horrible. It was just not something I ever want to live through again. And even telling the story is uncomfortable. So, you know, I've worked in hospitals. I know how it is. There is nobody slacking off at the hospital. Everyone in the ER is trying to be as efficient as they can be. They're just overwhelmed. I get it. As it happened, this was a Saturday during Lollapalooza, which is one of the biggest events in Chicago, with lots of kids who are drinking too much and taking too many drugs and clogging up the ER. And some of them are in life-threatening situations. So after a couple hours, I told my wife to go home. She had to work the next day, and she wasn't really helping any. I mean, it's nice to have the comfort there, but I was in so much pain that whatever comfort she could offer was mitigated. So she went home, and I just stayed there by myself. And my way of dealing with this was to keep walking. I probably annoyed the hell out of every other patient in there, but at that point, I didn't care. I just walked and walked and walked and walked, and I walked in kind of a stomping manner because I was trying to get this stone in my kidney to dislodge and make its way to my bladder. That was my goal. And maybe 4 hours into this, now at this point, I had been in excruciating pain for probably 6 hours. I felt a wave of relief. I didn't actually feel the stone move or anything like that, but I suddenly felt like, oh. And I felt good. Basically, I had just flooded my system with endorphins because I believe the stone moved. And it's I hate to say that it was pleasurable, but it was really a relief. It felt very, very good. So I stopped walking around and had a seat, and I had a seat strategically, and I just waited patiently. It's probably 1 o'clock in the morning at this point. And then all this drama starts happening. This guy is brought in. He's bleeding everywhere. He has just been shot, you know, Chicago. And there's all these people running around, and then his brother comes in, and he's screaming and yelling, everyone, my brother's back there, he's been shot, you better let me go see him. And he rushes into the back, and then 30 seconds later, he's in handcuffs being dragged out of the building. I mean, lots and lots of drama. But all of this I'm watching makes me think that I am such a low priority that I'm not going to get seen for a very, very long time. And in fact, I was in the waiting room for 9 hours before I got seen by a doctor. The only attention I had received was triage, and then at some point in the middle of the night, I had my blood pressure checked. And that was it. When they took me back in, again, I was feeling pretty good at this point, so I didn't actually mind. They were so incredibly nice to me. It was weird. They were just like, they were happy to see me. I kept thanking them for, you know, doing this, and they were like, don't worry, we're very happy to help people like you, which was a little bit of a weird thing to say, and I don't know the context of that, because what was different about me? I mean, I guess I wasn't belligerent. I don't know. So they took me in for a scan and a CAT scan, and they found that I had 2 stones lodged in my kidney, and then I went through the normal process, which is that they will give you pain meds there and give you a prescription for Flomax and some more pain meds, and then a little strainer that you're supposed to pee into to hopefully catch the stones. Now, in my case, I went through another bout of pain the next night, but knowing that it was kidney stones and knowing what was going to happen made it easier to get through. I took all the drugs, and here's some advice. If you ever think you have a kidney stone, take all the drugs as soon as you can. You want to get ahead of the pain, because once the pain reaches its highest point, it's much harder to bring it back down. And in my case, I did happen to catch the stone, and it was an oxalate stone, which is the most common kind. And, you know, they recommend dietary changes, drink a lot of water, etc. Anyway, the point I want to emphasize here is that in the U.S., you can easily wait 9 hours in the ER, even if you're in extreme pain. They don't care about pain. They care about your breathing and your blood pressure and things like that. If your blood pressure is too high or too low and you're having trouble breathing, you're going to get back sooner. But if you're just in pain, they're not going to help you. So if you are visiting the U.S. or you have never experienced this before, know that you are on your own for pain management. And ibuprofen can actually do an awful lot of good when dealing with kidney stones. Talk to your doctor about this. I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to give you medical advice. I'm just trying to tell you what the reality is. Oh, and the bills for all this? Yeah, we don't want to talk about that so much. But it was in the 5 figures. So, yeah. USA, we're number one. A place to visit. Hey, if you've ever driven I-80 east or west through Kearney, Nebraska, and that's how they pronounce it, K-E-A-R-N-E-Y, looks like it should be Kearney, but they pronounce it Kearney. You go under this big arch, and it's a little bit of a tourist trap, kind of an attraction thing, and it's kind of okay. If you have an hour to kill or whatever, going through the arch is an interesting thing. It's actually kind of a museum that tells the history of westward expansion and stuff, and there's a window that you can look out over the highway that's kind of neat. But if you don't want to spend the money, and you want to get away from the honky-tonk and want to see some real stuff, at that same exit, just down the frontage road from the arch, is the Nebraska Firefighters Museum. And this is an interesting place. I went in there, and my trip there could actually be its own tale from the road, because when I went there, it was open. The doors were open. I was during the hours it said it was open, but the lights were all off. I thought that was odd. And there were no people, and I walked in, and then the lights all turned on, like in some movie, like clunk, clunk, clunk. And yeah, then I wandered around the museum and looked at all these old fire engines and fire uniforms and fire apparatus, and saw how they used to be steam engines, and then they went from horses, and why Dalmatians are associated with firefighters and all this stuff. It was a really cool little museum. And in my case, I ran into people on the way out, and they were shocked that I was in there. I don't know what was going on. They had 2 employees who went out back for some reason. And I kind of sneaked in, and they didn't know I was there, but didn't matter. If you are traveling I-80 and looking for a break, and you might need one on I-80, go ahead and skip the arch and go to the Nebraska Firefighters Museum. You can spend a half hour or an hour there and see some real stuff. Nobody's trying to make a buck off of you. It's just nice pieces of history, and you get to learn a lot about what firefighting has been like in the last several hundred years of the U.S. You can find out more information at the NebraskaFirefightersMuseum.org website, or I have a link in the show notes. Resource recommendation. Little bit of an odd resource here, but a good one. You know, everyone almost everyone doing van life has their favorite YouTube channels, and whatever you watch, good for you. I'm not trying to influence what you watch. But one of the first channels that I started watching when I was really getting into van life was Kira and the Survival Pod. Now, I found out about Kira from Foresty Forest, who helped her build out her van. And Kira does not publish all that often. She kind of does it in spurts, but she has an interesting life up in Canada where she works on movies and, you know, has the normal life challenges, and she's in an NV200, which, of course, I was interested in because when I first started doing this, it was in an NV200, and so I could see what she did and what I did and all this stuff. Anyway, Kira is just a lovely person, and it's fun watching her kind of go through life and life struggles and challenges and see her celebrations and some of the hardships she goes through. But one thing that's always true for Kira is that it's all real. She's not trying to sell anything. She's not talking about, ooh, Athletic Greens are the best product. I mean, you don't get any of that. All you get is, here's my day. Here's what I'm thinking about. You can look at my meal if you'd like. This is what I made for today. And it's just nice. It's just a nice place to be. Kira creates these moments that she shares with us so we can just kind of see what real life is like for a lot of folks. And she finds wonderful places to visit up there in Canada. And if you do check her show out, again, it's Kira and the Survival Pod on YouTube, check out her van. She has a fairly minimal build. And I want to point out something very important. She's in Canada. It's cold up there, and she has no insulation at all. Her van is bare metal, and she's been doing this for years. So I ask you, just how important is insulation? I think people spend way, way too much time on insulation when it ultimately is it's a nice to have. It can help with some things, but it's not as important as people make it out to be. And Kira is living proof of that. So Kira, if you're listening, thank you for the years of enjoyable YouTubing. I appreciate your authenticity, and I wish you the best luck with all your future endeavors. And for the rest of you, go ahead and check out Kira and the Survival Pod on YouTube. I think you'll be glad you did. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 216. I am honored. It is my privilege to be able to yap at you each and every week, and thank you for being here. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg, and if you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am jeff@builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And until next time, remember the words of Sam Keen, who said, "Deep summer is when laziness finds respectability."